Welcome to West Virginia Week, a regular podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting that looks back at the major stories of the week. Another year's legislative session is now behind us, but news of a special session this spring means the West Virginia legislature won't be gone for long. In the meantime, we'll dive into stories on education, including a new study on special education and a group of West Virginia principals that visited the U.S. Capitol. Plus, we'll discuss potential expansions to passenger train services, protections for residents with long COVID, and the return of the beaver to Appalachia. Finally, we'll listen to the first installment of a new series on parenting that will explore the most up-to-date advice for infant care. I'm your host this week, Jack Walker. Let's jump right in with a few short news stories. Workers suffering from long COVID may be eligible for workplace protections and accommodations under federal law. Emily Rice has more.
A recent analysis published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that West Virginia was among the states with the highest prevalence rate of long COVID in the country at greater than 9%. Tracy DeFritis is a program leader with the Job Accommodation Network, a service that is funded by the Office of Disability Employment Policy.
I think it's important to keep in mind that the accommodations can really vary, and there can be temporary and long-term support that can be beneficial to individuals.
Workers may have difficulty working the same way they did before and may be entitled to temporary or longer-term support that can help them stay on the job or return to work once ready. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Emily Rice in Charleston.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health. Far southern West Virginia has been without a passenger rail service since 1979. As Curtis Tate reports, a federal study hints at a potential revival.
The Federal Railroad Administration has been studying the potential of expanding Amtrak service in West Virginia, including making the Cardinal from New York to Chicago a daily train. A PowerPoint presentation from the agency at least hints it might be considering a revival of a train that was discontinued more than 40 years ago, the Hilltopper. That train once stopped in Bluefield, Welch, and Williamson on its way from Boston and Washington, D.C. to Catlettsburg, Kentucky. Despite the support of powerful lawmakers, including the late Senator Robert C. Byrd, the train fell to sweeping Carter administration cuts on October 1, 1979. The Federal Railroad Administration study doesn't commit to restoring the Hilltopper, but could revisit the route in the future. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
A familiar species is coming back to West Virginia, and conservationists are preparing for new arrivals. Beavers are back in West Virginia, and according to conservationists, that's a good thing. Their dams increase biodiversity, store groundwater, and filter pollutants. Beavers are native to wetlands across North America and never fully disappeared in Appalachia, but they were hunted to near extinction during the 18th century fur trade. Fewer people hunt beavers for their pelts now, which has helped their population grow. But more beavers can also bring trouble. Their dams cause flooding, and beavers sometimes chew trees that protect rivers from erosion. Allison Zack, who founded the Human Beaver Coexistence Fund, said that's why conservationists are putting wire fences around trees along riverbanks.
People learning these non-lethal strategies is a way to keep beavers, like creating wetlands for other species and providing all the benefits that they provide for the ecosystem, but also addressing people's concerns about their favorite trees coming down.
Protecting both trees and beavers is a group effort. That's why Casey Walters with the Potomac Valley Audubon Society brought a team of volunteers to a Charlestown wetland Tuesday.
So yeah, it's not just, conservation is not just about the relationship with the wildlife. It's also about the relationships of the human organizations that exist and keeping us all working together for a common goal.
Walters estimated that Charlestown's Cool Spring Preserve is currently home to two beavers. But with the river's trees protected, it'll be ready for more to come. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jack Walker in Charlestown. Hundreds of education leaders from across the country were in the nation's capital Wednesday to advocate for more support to address the mental health and educator shortage crises. Chris Schultz has more.
School administrators from across the country are urging Congress to prioritize educational spending in current budget negotiations. John Conrad, principal of Westwood Middle School in Morgantown, spent the morning meeting with the staff of West Virginia's congressional delegation. He says schools in West Virginia rely on a myriad of federal funds to function.
People are very familiar with Title I, but also Title II and Title IV and IDEA and state grants, just hoping that they at least keep the level funding.
Conrad says he was able to meet directly with Senator Joe Manchin and urged him to support specific federal legislation to address mental health and staffing issues in schools. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
Governor Jim Justice will call a special session of the state legislature to address budget priorities missed in the regular session. Chris Schultz has the story.
The governor had already discussed calling a special session in May before the final gavel of the regular session Saturday night. But during a regular briefing Thursday, a visibly frustrated Justice said he is likely to call legislators back to the Capitol before the May 14 primary election. He said the proposed budget was rushed, omitting key tax breaks for families and creating a, quote, big-time problem for the newly formed Department of Human Services.
We spent a lot of time talking about issues that were more social issues and forgot to budget. And absolutely at the last minute, we tried to run in and switch this and that and everything else, and we made a bunch of mistakes.
Justice explained that waiting until after the mid-May elections would push the budget process too close to the end of the fiscal year. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
Last month, Beckley, West Virginia was poised to become the first city nationally to earn the special status of Inclusive Recovery City. Now, the city's dropped that plan entirely. Beckley residents packed the city council meeting Tuesday to denounce the city's addiction recovery plans. Some, like resident Mary West, were worried about attracting more people with addictions to the city.
All these homeless people that I see walking through here and down in front of my house, throwing backpacks in my yard with drugs.
West Virginia has the highest overdose death rate nationally. The plan would have offered citywide recovery resources, but Mayor Rob Rappold dropped the plan Thursday following national trends. Resident concerns over homelessness and drug use have blocked rehab expansions across the country, even as overdoses rise nationally. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jack Walker in Shepherdstown. You're listening to West Virginia Week, and now some of our top feature stories from the past week. Flood events are becoming more frequent and severe in West Virginia, causing millions of dollars in damage to property, disrupting communities, and displacing lives. Curtis Tate spoke with Nicholas Zagre, an associate professor of forest hydrology at West Virginia University, about what's behind this trend.
What makes West Virginia and Appalachia so vulnerable to severe, frequent floods?
When we think about floods, in particular in West Virginia, we have to think about them as two ways. One is what we call a riverine-based flood. So the larger rivers that flood when they spill over the stream, the riverbanks onto the floodplain, which of course are normally dry areas. And so when we look at flooding in West Virginia, we see that riverine flooding, there are hot spots in the eastern panhandle where we see a lot of that riverine flooding. And that's associated with like the Ridge and Valley, like, you know, the large rivers like the Potomac, that the Ridge and Valley topography kind of creates these really wide river valleys that provide a floodplain. And we certainly have that in other parts of the state. But when we think about like hot spots in the state, the eastern panhandle, the riverine flooding is a big problem.
Okay.
But the other type of flooding we're concerned about in West Virginia is flash flooding. And flash flooding can happen anywhere. It can happen certainly in our small streams and our heavily dissected, headwater valleys where 85% of our streams in West Virginia are small streams. And of course, we know we have people living up and down just about every hollow in West Virginia. And so in perspective, we actually have two hotspots. We have a hot spot in the West Fork watershed, kind of in that Clarksburg, Bridgeport, Harrison County area. And then we also see a flash flooding hot spot kind of central to Kanawha and what we refer to as kind of those southern coalfield counties. Now, that said, flash flooding and riverine flooding does happen everywhere throughout the state. But if we're thinking about, a higher propensity for flash flooding or for riverine flooding, we do see these emerging trends on where there a greater probability of them happening.
So for example, in the 2016 flood disaster in southern West Virginia, was it more the second type?
When they started collecting stories of what the flood looked like, the 2016 flood looked like, and when from the community and the first responder perspectives, and then when we started looking at what the floods looked like from a hydrology perspective, what became clear was it was a different type of flood in different parts of the Greenbrier watershed. So around Richwood and Raynell, for example. That was more cut flash flood, a wall of water moving very, very quickly downslope. Whereas when you were in the White Sulphur Springs and kind of Lewisburg area, it was more of a riverine flood where the river level rose and kind of spilled over and filled the wider valley. And what's interesting, Curtis, is when you start thinking about where the damage was and vulnerability and also recovery, we saw very different damage and very different approaches to response and recovery in Raynell versus like White Sulphur Springs. And, you know, we can tie that back to the different types of floods. But I should say that in the case of the 2016 flood, there were a lot of flash floods that routed downstream that also contributed to the larger riverine flood. And so we can have multiple types of floods occurring in the same event, which is going to be related to the topography and the stream channel and what all that looks like.
What's driving the heavier rainfall?
Heavier rainfalls are the result of a warmer atmosphere. You know, we think of the atmosphere as like a balloon. And if you blow up the balloon in your house in January and it's warm inside your house, you know, the balloon is expanded. And if you walk outside in that cold winter day, that balloon is going to contract. I walk back inside to that warm house and the balloon's going to expand. So that's what's happening with warming temperatures in the atmosphere. With a warmer temperature, the atmosphere expands, which means it can store more water. But with warmer temperatures, there's more evaporation of water from our soils and our trees and our rivers and our lakes. And so more water is being put into the atmosphere and more of that water can be stored in the atmosphere. And once the atmosphere reaches saturation, we have these very heavy, intense rainfalls. And so heavy rainfall and air temperature is clearly related. In fact, for a single 1 degree temperature increase and 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in air temperature, the atmosphere can hold 4% more water. And so as the atmosphere warms, it holds more water and it creates more rainfall.
How much does land use, whether commercial, residential, or industrial, contribute to the problem?
Whether it is what we would call an old growth forest, or a Walmart parking lot. If you drop 8 to 10 inches of rain in a couple of hours, like what was experienced in Eastern Kentucky two summers ago, there's going to be flooding. Our systems just aren't designed to handle that much water. But land use activities very much affect how quickly water runs off. And so impervious surfaces associated with industrialization, associated with urbanization, and associated with, the result of surface mining. All of this routes water more quickly, more water is routed more quickly off that landscape. And so when we think about, you know, how do we mitigate these effects of extreme rainfall and flooding, putting our landscape back into forests is a really important part of this conversation. Land use is a really important driver of flooding. But I should also say that it's really hard to detect the effects of like a single neighborhood or a single mine or a single, you know, clear-cut parcel and the effect that has on flooding. And so we often think about this, we know how water cycles through the atmosphere and through the earth. And so what happens when we remove forests and remove soils? That water can't be stored and that water is not removed from runoff. So all of that goes downstream.
That was Nicholas Zegre of the WVU Mountain Hydrology Laboratory speaking with Curtis Tate about flooding in West Virginia. A new analysis of special education data hopes to advance understanding and solutions for students with the greatest need. Chris Schultz has more.
Over the past 5 years, overall enrollment in West Virginia's public schools has declined by nearly 10%. However, educators like Rachel Brown say during the same period, the numbers of special education students have gone up.
Everyone's overworked as our numbers keep rising, and our county has done a lot of cuts this year because of our enrollment numbers have gone down, but we couldn't cut. Our numbers have gone up.
Brown is the IDAU, That's Intellectual Disabilities and Autism, Special Education Curriculum Specialist for Kanawha County Schools. She oversees more than 60 self-contained classrooms across the county, where students with the most complex needs, who require the most support, are placed. The increase is not unique to Kanawha County, the state's largest school district.
Everywhere. It's increasing everywhere. I was discussing with a specialist yesterday, 10 years ago, she was in a rural part of the county, and I was like, I bet you had a sweet, tiny little classroom of like five. Now, in the same location, we have two self-contained classrooms at the school, and they're both full. That's a huge change, you know, over a decade.
A new analysis from the Institute for Policy Research and Public Affairs at West Virginia University's Rockefeller School of Policy and Politics is quantifying some of those changes. Samuel Workman is the director of the institute.
In West Virginia, it is a problem of some magnitude. We're talking between, depending on the year you look, anywhere from 40,000 to 50,000 students. So it constitutes about 1 in 5 in the current year. Of students. So 20% of our students, that's a great number of our young folks who are on independent educational plans.
He and his team analyzed the last 5 years of Individuals with Disabilities Education Act data, also known as IDEA, from the West Virginia Department of Education. The report compiled a data set from 2017 to 2023 addressing the demographics, geography, and trends in independent educational plans, or IEPs, in the state.
States will monitor things like how often these kids are in normal classrooms, or standard classrooms, I should say, any disciplinary actions taken against these children, and sort of assessing performance over time, both for their sake and relative to other students.
Workman's study shows the breadth of conditions, both physical and developmental, covered by IEPs. They run the gamut from difficulty with vision or hearing to psychological issues. The largest category is now specific learning disabilities, which Workman says the federal government defines as psychological problems with processing language. Categories like autism and developmental delay have also witnessed increases, especially in recent years.
Which I understand to be associated with a whole host of environmental problems in children, substance abuse in a home being one. But those are the sorts of things we are seeing, at least in present time, sort of explosion is probably too strong of a word, but certainly sharp upticks in the number of children categorized within those disability categories versus the traditional sort of hearing disabilities and this sort of stuff.
The analysis reveals interesting demographic distributions, including the fact that a near two-thirds majority of students on IEPs are male. More data and study is needed to better understand such discrepancies, as well as the relationship between the various factors driving the trends, including the opioid crisis and lack of access to resources like early childhood interventions. Workman credits the state's Department of Education for making the data easier to access. He hopes his study helps to make it easier to use and understand, and ultimately, bring more eyes to the issue.
The way I organize data is not the way, say, a public health person would organize the data. It's not the way an education professional organizes data. And so continuing to work to make that data as integratable as possible with our public health systems and our education systems will work wonders in understanding the nature of the problem, what we're dealing with.
Workman says with 1 in 5 students having IEPs, the far-reaching effect of education, from the immediate impact of each student to the broader implications for workforce development and businesses, makes a better understanding of special education needs imperative.
The degree to which we can better understand these children, help them to the extent possible to lead sort of productive, rich lives, both at home and at their place of work and all this sort of stuff, the better the off the state's going to be. It's a real problem with a real need for lots of eyes.
Brown agrees.
Numbers mean a lot and data means a lot. I always have hope. That's the best part of being a special educator. So yeah, I'm hoping that this will help make special education a priority and just education in general a priority in our state.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
Discussions between grandparents and new parents reveal just how much advice around what's best for baby has changed in one generation. From sleep positions to even clothing and nutrition, what's recommended or even considered safe has shifted more than many realize. In the first installment of a new series called Now What?, a series on parenting, reporter Chris Schultz sat down with Dr. Adriana Diakiv, an assistant professor of pediatrics at West Virginia University, to discuss how things have changed and what doctors recommend today.
Why has that change happened? Why has so much changed around best practices for infant care?
Well, the answer is simply based on the evidence. So over the last 30 years, we have learned so much about the best way to take care of newborns. And one of the things that here at WVU, and I think sort of more globally, that pediatricians like to practice is what we call evidence-based medicine. And the recommendations for newborn baby care are based on what we consider the best evidence. And that is constantly changing and evolving. And we have learned so much, not just in the last 30 years, but even in the last 10 years, about the best way to feed and care for babies.
Let's start with sleep. Why is the back the best position for an infant for sleep?
Being on the back is the only safe sleep position for an infant. It is true that in general, babies are somewhat more comfortable on their tummy. However, around 30 years ago, we learned that babies who are put to sleep on their tummy have about a 50% increased risk of dying of sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. And that evidence is so strong that the American Academy of Pediatrics issued a recommendation and a campaign called the Back to Sleep Campaign, that one of the most important things that they can do for their newborn baby's health is to always put them to sleep on their back.
Why is the focus on milk or formula only now?
When we refer to milk, of course, we're speaking of human breast milk. So mom's breast milk has such a tremendous variety of health benefits. But if we're not going to be taking mom's breast milk, then a infant formula is the only safe way to feed your baby between birth and 12 months. If a baby gets too much water mixed in with their milk or their formula, the way that the baby's kidneys work and their fluid balance works, they can't just get rid of that extra water so easily. So it can have some pretty negative health effects for the baby.
Talk to me a little bit about what the modern recommendations are towards ensuring that a baby is at a comfortable temperature.
So with newborn babies in particular, it's very important to avoid overheating or overbundling a newborn baby, because overheating is one of the biggest risk factors for sudden infant death syndrome, apart from being placed to sleep on your stomach. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is to avoid overheating a newborn or an infant.
What can you tell me about how the pediatric field's perception or understanding of colic is changing even as we speak?
Our perception of colic has changed dramatically over the past several years. So this is a field in which there's a lot of active research. Colic had, for generations, been understood as abdominal discomfort. But there's another definition of colic, which actually has nothing to do with tummy pain or with pain at all. And that interpretation of colic, which we don't quite have a separate word for yet, we now understand as more of a developmental process. We think of a baby when they're born full term as really having been born 3 months too early. And this is the idea of the fourth trimester, right? So babies, when they're first born, in order to even be able to pass through the birth canal, a baby has to be born about 3 months earlier than their brain is and nervous system is really ready to face the world. And so as a result, the baby's parent or caregiver acts almost like an external nervous system for the baby during the first 3 months. And human babies are unique in the animal kingdom, really, in being utterly helpless when they are born. They depend on their parents for everything, and newborns have absolutely no ability to self-soothe. And that's because during that first 3 months, their brain and nervous system is so immature and it's growing and changing so rapidly that a baby can easily become overstimulated. And when we've looked at babies who have this unexplained crying, which we also call colic, we found that these colicky babies actually are not in pain. And we can test for this, actually. They're not in pain at all. It's more that their nervous system is so overstimulated that the only way that they can express that overstimulation is with this inconsolable crying. And it's kind of a tough thing to wrap your mind around when you've always been taught that your baby's unexplained crying is because they have excess gas or colic or tummy pain.
That was Dr. Adriana Diakiev speaking with reporter Chris Schultz about the modern best practices for infant care. To read a longer version of this interview, go to our website at wvpublic.org. That's it for West Virginia Week. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you back here next week. As always, you can see these stories and more at wvpublic.org. I'm Jack Walker.